Okay, our panellists today are Oliver Harvey, who's the Senior Executive Leader, Financial Markets Infrastructure at ASIC. We also have Mark Chambers, who's the Senior Management Payment System Stability at the Payments Policy Department at the Reserve Bank of Australia. Then we have Paul Jones, who's the General Manager, Clearing Risk Policy at ASX. And we have Andrew Bourne, who's Head of Portfolio Trading at the Credit Portfolio Management side of Westpac. And Fred Pucci, who's Head of Compliance, International and Institutional Banking at ANZ. But Mark, perhaps you could take on the point there about sort of the Australia perhaps hasn't been fully included in the debate and the development of the broader regulatory landscape.
Oh, I think we've certainly been participants at all the global forums where this has been discussed. I think you know, someone had to go first. I think that's the tricky thing. Someone had to go first. Did it make sense for Australia to go first globally? I don't think so. I think it made sense for perhaps the US or Europe to go first. I think even Europe is sort of complaining about some of the things that Andrew just noted, in that, you know, the US has had to start from a blank bit of paper, has had to sort of set out this whole roadmap, has had to sort of set itself a very ambitious timeline, both... I think that was important, really, just to get things happening. If ambitious timelines had not been set, then I don't think we would be where we are today. So someone had to go first. Someone had to make some crucial decisions about what the framework would look like. Tiny little things, well, not tiny little things, but really nitty gritty details about appropriate, what was acceptable documentation as far as client clearing, all these sorts of very detailed questions. And it's all come in a rush, and I think everyone's having this massive digestion problem as we sort of look towards the end of this year. For Australian regulators, I mean, we really had to wait and see what the international landscape was looking like, where the regulators in these large markets were going, before we could really start gearing up for implementing a framework here in Australia as well. So I don't think it's a question of not being at the table, but a question of waiting to see what was going to come out before we could make our move.
Mm-hmm. So it's fair to say that the G20 deadline is not going to be met?
I'm not going to say that. I think what we will see is that pretty much in most countries, including Australia, you'll have a framework in place ready to put it into action. I think it's fair to say that it's turned out to be much more complicated than perhaps the sort of the three lines or whatever in that Pittsburgh 2009 summit suggested it would be. And even the US, which Dodd-Frank was passed, was July 2010, and we're still only now getting to the point of actual implementation of any of those things. So it's taken 2 years, more than 2 years in the US, and still they're still talking about a phased-in timetable of sort of going with the big players first and then sort of slowly increasing the product scope and the participant scope. I think there will be substantial progress by the end of this year.
Okay, perhaps I could sort of bring Mark in at this point, because obviously there's been some, certainly from the Hong Kong regulator has mandated that Hong Kong dollar swaps need to be cleared locally, and there's been quite a lot of sort of a location requirement, and obviously the Singaporeans have opted for you can clear anywhere. From your perspective, is there a regulatory imperative to the clearing? And I'm particularly thinking of sort of Aussie dollar swaps at the moment. Is there a regulatory imperative to clearing some of this locally, or are you sort of agnostic over where it's cleared?
I think we're agnostic, subject to whichever facility it is doing the clearing is one that's satisfactory to the Australian regulators. That's both the Reserve Bank and ASIC, and ultimately the government. For instance, if there was an offshore CCP that was clearing a systemically important component of the market, so had a substantial share of, say, Aussie dollar swaps or something like that, and it had Australian banks as participants and had a large chunk of the Australian market, I guess what the Reserve Bank would be saying at that point, okay, you offshore CCP, you need to have an exchange settlement account at the Reserve Bank, which means you're able to sort of clear and settle your Australian dollar transactions in central bank money rather than rely on sort of correspondent banking arrangements. That's not to say that we would then go further and say, well, and not only that, but you need to have all your machines that go ping and your management expertise and treasury operations, all that sort of thing, located in Sydney or wherever it might be, it would still be comfortable with it being based offshore, subject to it being regulated by someone we had good relationship with and we're able to have, you know, good dialogue with.
And I'll just add to that, I would say that, you know, the regulator is very, very eager to strike a balance between having the domestic presence in the right domestic regulatory settings and facilitating the international marketplace.
I might just go on. I guess the thing is we want to be agnostic because we as much as possible want to leave it up to the market participants to decide what their preferences is. I mean, Paul just ran through some of the selling points of what, you know, ASX is looking to offer, and that to the extent that that's attractive to Australian market participants and that attracts a sort of a substantial share of business, that's fine, that's great. But if there's a different mix of participants and who's, you know, business model and portfolio and exposures means that they're better off using an offshore CCP, which has a slightly different mix of products and service offering, then, you know, we'd want to be looking to accommodate that as well. We don't really want to be telling the end users or intermediaries here in Australia which ones they can and can't use.
That sounds like the regulators have had to kind of walk a slight diplomatic tightrope when they're assessing these issues. So to take a slightly broader view and perhaps move away from the specific Australian issues is to touch on some of the points that Andrew made earlier. Given that you have in both a European and American context the likelihood of a single clearinghouse emerging, and yet in the context of the Australian market, the Asian market, you have a number of clearinghouses, whether it be Singapore, Hong Kong, Tokyo, and also Korea are looking to introduce their clearinghouse. Is the Asian market perhaps at a slight disadvantage from the sort of multiplicity of clearing centres versus the European and North American market? I mean, perhaps I could put this to Oliver from your perspective. Does that give some sort of structural issues for the Australian market then?
Well, Mark, then you take over on this one. I know you had a particular focus on clearing and settlement, so I'll let you.
Well, I mean, firstly, I guess I would say that I'm not sure that the landscape is exactly as you described it in Europe or US. I mean, perhaps the US, I think it's a fairly cutthroat competition going on there at the moment between CME and LCH. In Europe, you've got the likes of Eurex, for instance, looking to clear euro-denominated contracts in direct competition with someone like LCH. You've got some of the other, some of the non-euro countries are looking to, exchanges in those non-euro countries are looking to set up clearing houses for their particular individual countries. I think, you know, the Scandinavian exchanges are moving in that direction. I think some of the Eastern European countries are moving in that direction. So I think even Europe is facing a fairly fragmented short-term future, at least. Where liquidity ends up, ultimately, I guess it's hard to predict. And I think that's the approach. Given that there's a sort of, we're in this transition phase of people trying out new models and trying to provide different service offerings and different selling points to the intermediaries and the end users, I think that's what we're looking to foster here in Australia. In terms of Asia, well, I guess it depends very much on the nature of the underlying sort of end user demand. So, for instance, in Hong Kong, I mean, if there's a natural population of end users who are only interested in clearing Hong Kong dollars and don't need the cross-margin benefits of an LCH or a CME, then it doesn't really matter whether it's fragmented or happening through a single CCP. I guess the deal is that the clearing members are a bit grumpy about that because it means they have to go to the expense of hooking up to multiple CCPs, and that's why they're looking for operational efficiencies and as much standardisation around just workflows as much as possible. And, you know, that's something where you know, it's useful to have those conversations with other regulators and the institutions. But I'm not sure that fragmentation... I'm not sure that it should be characterised as a sort of a debate about fragmentation. It's more about what the underlying demand and portfolios of the end users are and the extent to which that can be serviced by the dealer community.
Mark, perhaps I could bring you in on this point in terms of the biggest difficulty that you're facing at the moment. What are you kind of wrestling with?
Oh, look, I think I couldn't surpass that comment about the importance of cross-border coherence of these things. I mean, In the Australian regulators thinking through the approach we should be taking, it's been very apparent that the market we're dealing with here in Australia is one that's enormously cross-border in nature, and that the participants, even if the transaction is executed here and done by someone sitting at a desk in Sydney, very often it's going to get booked back to an entity in the US or Europe. At the same time, Australian banks or other Australian end users, fund managers and so forth, they may be located here in Australia and may be booking things into Australia, but they're executing offshore. They're executing against counterparties based offshore. So it's these questions of making sure that any regulations or rules that we put in place here in Australia don't have this effect of making it effectively a transaction impossible. It can't meet the requirements of an offshore jurisdiction and an onshore one. I mean, there may be circumstances where we simply can't come to agreement, but I don't think that that's going to be the case. I think, we have got very useful open dialogues with regulators in the region and in Europe and US, and the one thing that has come out of these past few years of sort of pushing hard on these G20 commitments is a drastic increase in the amount of conversations we have cross-border with other regulators, and I think that should mean that some of the frictions that might otherwise have existed will be smoothed over.
Okay. Just to engage in my job of being the annoying person, interest rate swaps are clearly not the problem in Australia. We like our customers. We understand them well. We've got a local presence. We've got a really good credit office that looks after those. We have enormous amounts of collateralisation with the pro market. And fundamentally, we want to take credit risk on our customers because we understand them well. The regulation that the G20 signed up to is, roughly speaking, not going to achieve anything in terms of stability in the Australian banking system at the edges it will. And the reason why I say that is the majority of the positions that we have that are concerning and that are actually going to use up phenomenally large amounts of initial margin when we're forced to initial margin is cross-currency swaps, where the Australian banking complex has about $350 billion of open foreign exchange exposures to foreign banks. Now, that $350 billion of open foreign exchange exposures is an enormous amount of credit risk usage and an enormous amount of jump to default exposure, because although we are collateralised, in the event that one of those counterparties fails, it will take us some time to realise that loss. That looks like something around 8% of the amount of those outstandings will have to be held as initial margin, which is $54 billion, because both parties are going to have to hold it. Now, that is actually a massive game changer if there is some way of managing that. But frankly, for Australian banks, the clearing of our, quotes, vanilla business, I don't think makes a massive difference to the strength of the Australian economy. And just to draw a little parallel, Lehman's, when they defaulted, had all of their vanilla stuff sitting in SwapClear. And so SwapClear cleared all the Lehman's positions and gave back three-quarters of the Lehman's initial margin to the bankruptcy trustee. All the interesting stuff Lehman's did that was outside of clearing, they got back 20 cents in the dollar. So, it's just one of those things that we're kind of operating in an environment that certainly allows us to say, yes, we've gone to clearing, we understand this range of risks, but in fact, it's probably not the key risks.
Mark?
I guess a few things that I'd respond to there. Firstly, the Australian regime has not yet said anything about what share or what extent to which end users might need to be sort of mandated to centrally clear. I guess that will be a genuine open discussion for when consultation takes place, if there is a mandatory clearing obligation that gets implemented. So there will be plenty of opportunity to have those discussions and sort of quantify these effects and say, well, the line between sort of thresholds between exemptions are not where that should be drawn. But that said, I think these debates around where that threshold should be drawn also should be coloured by understanding what's going on with the Basel III capital charges. And I guess that will be looked at later sessions during today, but there will be a strong incentive to centrally clear where that's possible. The FX market, I think, yes, that's a genuine challenge. There is a difficulty in the current settlement process for FX transactions is not well suited to being married up to central clearing at the moment. So that's something that the regulators are looking at on an international level. I mean, understandably, given it is the foreign exchange market, it does require quite a lot of coordination amongst many jurisdictions to sort of work through the issues there. But that work is ongoing. But Andrew also raised the question of what's going on with the initial margin there. Well, I think it's probably worth noting that there is a work stream, and this probably is probably not necessarily good news for many people, but there is a work stream going on in terms of imposing margin requirements on non-centrally cleared transactions. There's a consultation paper out at the moment that the Basel Committee and IOSCO have put out. When did they go out? Start of July, something like that, it went out. So that's still currently open for consultation. But in that, it is proposed that for larger institutions, financial institutions, that when they contract with each other, that they post initial margin to each other on a bilateral basis. So in a worst-case scenario, that does gross up quite substantially the amount of initial margin and collateral that is needed within the system. But related to that consultation process is there's a quantitative impact study taking place to try and flesh out exactly what sort of amounts we're talking about.
Sarah Percy-Dove with Colonial First State, one of the end users that's being impacted by this regulation. I guess for the regulators, I'm curious to know your views that if we're going to move forward with this, particularly on interest rate swaps, what the point of it is if the main users of interest rate swaps sits outside your regulatory powers, and I'm referring to the semi-governments. And I guess in that context from the ASX clearer, if the main users of interest rate swaps don't clear, what's your business case for continuing moving on?
Well, I guess in the first instance, most counterparties of banks will be having to absorb the capital. If they don't pass it on to end users, they will be absorbing the increased capital cost of not centrally clearing. So I would have, I don't know what specific arrangements banks will have with specific clients, but by and large, I would have thought that some cost differential will open up between not centrally clearing a standardised swap and centrally clearing it. And for people who are looking for, a couple of basis points difference, if that's important to them, then I would have thought that at the margin they're going to switch towards central clearing. And I would have thought that would apply across all end-user classes, whether they're semi-governments, fund managers, corporates, whoever they might be. That's going to be subject, of course, to their capacity to fund initial margin and sort of meet variation margin calls as needed. But so I don't envy the people who have to make the call there as to which path they go down. But I think at the margin we are going to see a migration to central clearing across all client bases. So the thing is, I mean, a lot of these end users are not just using OTC products where depending on their CSA, they may in fact not be posting variation margin. They may not be having to sort of fund those sort of daily mark-to-markets, and they're almost certainly not posting initial margin, or if they are, only in sort of limited amounts. But they are, very often using, typical exchange-traded futures where all those things are needed, where they are having to post initial margin, where they are having to meet variation calls. So I think there's this sort of a process to be gone through where people realise that what used to be OTC is now looking more and more like exchange traded, and these sort of differences will start to melt away. And I think you just sort of see a natural migration. It may not take 6 months, it may take 6 years, but you'll see more stuff going towards exchange traded.